Warning, the 619 Crimes podcast contains topics like violence, drug use, and suicide. Please consider this while listening today. Thank you.
Betty Broderick.
22-year-old John Ernest.
34-year-old Sean Nelson.
Kara Knott.
16-year-old Brenda Spencer.
29-year-old Ali Nasser Abulaban.
This is 619 Crimes Podcast, where every Wednesday we bring you short crime stories that took place in San Diego. I am your host, Al Rodriguez. What's up, everyone? We have official merch for the show. Every purchase will help us bring you better shows. I really want to keep improving, and I need to take more time to make the show. So the more purchases you guys make, the more time I'll be able to invest on the show. So if you would like to support, visit 619crimes.store and get your merch. Thank you so much. San Diego in 1995. That was the year that I was born, at the San Diego Sharp Memorial Hospital. 1995 is also the year where the tank rampage happened that we covered on episode 2. That year, bands like Duran Duran and Sublime performed at the San Diego State Open Air Theater. San Diego in 1995 is the San Diego that we got to go to for this case. So let's get to it. In August 1995, the first victim, who was referred to as Jane Doe 1, was out for a jog in Claremont Mesa. The victim was passing by a bridge, and a man jumped out at her with a knife and a ski mask on. The suspect ordered her to walk over to some bushes and lie on the ground. The victim followed all his orders, trying to survive. The suspect then proceeded to rape Jane Doe 1. The suspect took off, and the victim was able to make it home to her dad, and the dad called 911 and reported it to officers. When the cops got to her home, the cops stated that she was still in shock, but still she was able to lead the cops to the spot of the assault. Not much was found at the spot of the crime, but they did perform a rape kit on Jane Doe 1. 2 months later, there was another rape victim, just 10 miles away. This woman is referred to as Jane Doe 2. Jane Doe 2 got home and she walked into her living room and a stranger was standing there in all black and a ski mask on. He was holding a large kitchen knife. The victim was raped at knife point while being bound and gagged. She described to the cops that the suspect was a large man and he acted very in control. He never once raised his voice. As soon as the suspect took off, Jane Doe 2 was able to actually untie herself, and she ran to her phone to call 911. As she was on the phone with the cops, her boyfriend got home. He had just missed the suspect going out of the front door by minutes. There was a third rape on November 14th, 1995. The victim was home alone doing some work on her desk when she heard a noise. She assumed it was her boyfriend getting home. She got up and walked over to her window. She looked outside to her parking spot, but there was no car there. When she turned around, there was a large man standing just 6 feet away from her in all black, wearing a ski mask and holding a knife. He told her to be quiet or he will kill her. He then took her to the bedroom and told her to get on the floor. He raped the victim and then he climbed out of the window. The city was starting to realize there was a serial rapist on the loose. There was another attack just 4 days later. The victim was walking into her kitchen when a man ran up behind her wearing all black and again wearing a ski mask and also carrying a knife. DNA was also collected on this crime scene, so the cops now had four different DNA samples. When they tested them, it confirmed that all four attacks were all from the same man. The cops uploaded the DNA to CODIS, the National Database for Convicted Felons. There was no matches at the time. The cops had no leads, so they started to go out onto the streets and knock on doors. There was undercover officers all over the county, but they couldn't find anything. The rape attacks suddenly just stopped, and the case went cold. Until 7 years later in 2002, there was another attack. It was at nighttime. A woman was in her home getting her daughter to bed, and after closing her daughter's bedroom door, she turned around and saw a large man standing there with a knife and dressed in all black. He forced her into her bedroom, and the man told her that if she let herself be raped, he wouldn't hurt her daughter. In order to protect her daughter, the victim complied. When they collected a rape kit off of this victim, it was the same DNA from 1995. 2 years later, in November of 2004, there was another attack, but in Palm Desert. A woman got home with her daughter, and a man was waiting for them inside. He made sure they could see the big knife in order to get them to comply. This victim also told the cops that the man was calm and collected the entire time and never once raised his voice at them. With no leads, the case went cold for another 15 years. But in 2019, the case was given to Detective John Sullivan. John sent the DNA to CODIS again in 2019, hoping that by this point, the suspect had committed other crimes and had been arrested for it. But again, no matches, no luck. But then Detective John saw on the news the arrest of the Golden State Killer, and the way they caught him is by using genealogy. Detective John contacted the San Diego FBI offices and talked to FBI Special Agent Steve Bush. John gave him a rundown of the case and told him that he had DNA samples from all six attacks. The FBI sent it out to a laboratory. They got the snip back and they put it on GEDmatch. And they started to build a family tree. At first, all they had was distant cousins that matched. Then they went down from there. The suspect's DNA then matched with two brothers who lived close to the Palm Desert area. When they looked into these brothers, they had lived in San Diego in 1995. And both of them had moved out to the Palm Desert area in the 2000s. And the cops started to look at their social media accounts, and they noticed that the brothers were total opposites. One was a husband and a father and was very religious. The other was more of a wild guy, Christopher Van Berskirk. When the cops looked online and saw pictures of his wife, they noticed that his wife looked very similar to all six victims. Cops focused on Christopher. He was currently living in Phoenix, Arizona. The San Diego Police Department contacted Wyatt Storm, the detective in charge of the Phoenix Violent Task Force, and they asked him to surveillance Christopher. Detective Storm and his team started to follow Christopher, and they saw that he worked at a restaurant. The cops went undercover, and they actually went into the restaurant and sat down to eat some food. They started to make small talk with Christopher. Out of pure luck, Christopher sat down to eat for his lunch break. One of the cops actually went and sat right down in front of him. They began to talk. The cop finished his food, and then Christopher had to go back to work. When Christopher got up, he grabbed the cop's fork and plate and was about to take it to the back, but the cop told him he could throw it away himself. The cop then grabbed the fork that Christopher had touched and sealed it for evidence. Detective John Sullivan then made the whole 8-hour drive to Phoenix just for that fork. They sent that in for testing and they got a 100% match. The Phoenix cops got a warrant for his arrest and a search warrant. They showed up one morning to Christopher's house, but they couldn't find him. He wasn't home. They went out to his usual hangout spots and they couldn't find him anywhere. The superiors of the Phoenix officers decided that they should use a ruse. They saw that Christopher had filed a police report against a man for a credit card scheme. The detectives reached out to Christopher and they told him they just wanted to show him some pictures of some suspects of the credit card scheme. It worked. Christopher met with the cops and he was quickly arrested. Christopher was arrested without any fight. Christopher did refuse to talk to them and revoked his right to an attorney. so he was quickly extradited to San Diego the very next day. Detective John Sullivan was then sitting next to Christopher in the back of the Ford Taurus on the way to the airport to fly back to San Diego. In San Diego, he was charged with 6 counts of forcible rape, 6 counts of rape in the course of a robbery, and a charge of multiple victims, which allows for a death sentence in California. Then Christopher changed his mind, and he actually took a plea deal. He pleaded guilty to all 6 cases, which is a sentence of 50 years to life in prison. What's up, everyone? We have official merch for the show. Every purchase will help us bring you better shows. I really want to keep improving, and I need to take more time to make the show. So the more purchases you guys make, the more time I'll be able to invest on the show. So if you would like to support, visit 619crimes.store and get your merch. Thank you so much. Hope you enjoyed today's episode. The music for the show is created by Salvador Morales and hosted by me, Al Rodriguez. Please leave us a review on whatever platform you use so we can get the show in front of more people. We also ask that you click the share button and share with a friend. It would really help us. You can follow us on Instagram, TikTok, and YouTube at 619 Crimes Pod. This has been the 619 Crimes Podcast. See you guys next Wednesday. Peace.